Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Confounding, exhilarating, and contagious. Emotions matter, and so does applying emotional intelligence. Welcome to Dan Hill's EQ Spotlight, the podcast where emotions rule. Whatever the topic, how do hearts and minds collide? Find out with your host, a college professor turned globe-trotting EQ entrepreneur. His mission? Each week, Dan joins prominent authors in decoding how emotions drive outcomes and make people tick. Now, on to the show.
132nd episode of my podcast, Dan Hill's EQ Spotlight. The series appears here on the New Books Network, which has as its motto, sharing knowledge so people can thrive. Today's topic is, can China build a coalition? I'm joined by Andrew Small. He is the author of No Limits, the Inside Story of China's War with the West. The publisher is Melville House Publishing. Andrew is a senior transatlantic fellow with the Asia program at the German Marshall Fund of the United States. His previous book, The China-Pakistan Axis, received broad praise from the likes of the New York Review of Books, The Economist, and Foreign Affairs. He joins us today from Berlin. Welcome to the show, Andrew.
Thanks very much for having me on.
Absolutely. So briefly, what's the book about?
So, I mean, when I set out to write the book, I'd originally started with the intention of making sense of Europe's role for the US in this emerging contest between the United States and China. It became apparent that as the US rivalry with China was starting to take on not just military characteristics, but where economics and technology were at the core of this rivalry now, that Europe was going to start mattering a lot more in this contest. This wasn't just going to be about a pivot to Asia or a rebalancing to the Indo-Pacific. This was going to be about whether the Western allies, all of the advanced industrial democracies could pull together, and whether Europe, with its substantial concentration of economic and financial and technological power, was aligned with the United States or not. And so I kind of embarked on this process of research that started with that premise. But in the course of that, you started seeing all of these pretty revolutionary changes in how Europe itself started thinking about China. In the early stages of the research, the German Federation of Industry put out this paper calling China a systemic competitor. The European Union came out to declare China a systemic rival. And so I ended up trying to do something quite different, which was basically to just try and make sense of two things. One was, how was it that without being prompted by a single event, an economic shock, an invasion or something, this broad swathe of countries across the industrialized world were going through this huge revision of their fundamental assumptions about China, overhauling all of their policies pretty much that governed their approach for decades and starting to cooperate with each other openly in their collective response to that. And then there was the other side of the equation, which I think is how you've kind of framed the podcast, which was what was going on the coalition building on the other side. How was China's own thinking when it came to alliances, alignment, and coalition building moving? And what could the Chinese coalition in response look like? And so one chunk of the book deals with the first set of questions, and then the latter part of the book deals with that other piece of it. How do we move into an era of a contest of coalitions, a contest of systems? How straightforward is it for the two sides to do that coalition building? And what's this going to mean for the shape of future geopolitics and geoeconomics?
Okay. And to go right to emotions for at least one moment here in the interview, you mentioned repeatedly, in fact, the real emphasis on the lack of trust that engenders from China's interactions with other countries. Would you say in the act of coalition building that democracies may be more open and therefore better able to generate trust? Do they have an inherent advantage in forging alliances as opposed to more authoritarian governments such as China?
That's actually a very important question. And I think it has been the case that for some time, when we'd looked at coalition building on the Chinese side, we'd said this group of countries that China is dealing with, A, they don't trust each other, and B, insofar as they are able to coordinate policies together, it's a pretty motley crew. You basically have a cluster of countries that are North Korea, Iran, Cambodia, some occasional disaffected others, Pakistan, of course, as you mentioned with my previous book, is a close partner of China's. But you weren't really seeing something in this beyond a sort of periodic coalition of the disaffected. I think the big game changer from China's perspective was Russia. Could they get Russia on board? From the Chinese alliance thinkers, Russia's really been the big prize. And I think the striking thing is it's been the big prize for Xi Jinping through his entire time as general secretary of the party. But that has been a history totally marked by pervasive mistrust between the two sides. They've never been able to hold together a real level of alignment for more than a very limited period of time. Whereas on the other side of this, despite some of the differences that we've seen in recent years and across the decades between Europe and the United States, between the US and its allies in Asia, this is a much deeper and more potent coalition of countries that has been able to engender a level of mutual trust that does look qualitatively different from what you have on the Chinese side. So I think it's still, I think there's still a substantial edge that the US has. I think it's understood on the Chinese side to be one of the biggest weaknesses that they have in a certain sense in the contest that they see unfolding in this struggle that they see with the West, that in the end, despite their efforts to divide the United States and its democratic allies, it has been a grouping that's largely been able to operate on a coherent basis, and China's always struggled to do that. The big question is, can they get there with Russia right now? And I think that's what they're now testing out.
Sure. And let's stay with the Chinese-Russian connection here. I mean, I'm very struck by the fact that Xi is 69 years old. Putin is 70. Putin has just obviously gone into the Ukraine. Everyone's wondering whether or not Xi is going to go after Taiwan here at some point. I mean, what's your sense of that? I know that's putting you at risk of having to make some sort of prediction or at least forecast of what's going. But as I read your book and knowing in part that you're based in Berlin, I kept thinking about the buildup of Germany prior to World War One, and you know, I started thinking about time frames and wondering, my God, what are we possibly facing here in the near term?
Yeah, and I mean, when I lived in Beijing in the mid 2000s, and I used to get these readouts every now and then from the meetings that visiting leaders would have. One of the ones that struck me, and I mentioned quite early in the book, was one of the visits by Putin to Beijing, and the readout from the Chinese Politburo Standing Committee members who'd met with him through certain other third parties to me was. But they'd really had this kind of meeting of minds, not necessarily on the overall geostrategic picture, but certainly on their domestic issues, that they had this kind of shared outlook when it came to pushing back against what they saw as US-led color revolutions. They were kind of trading tips on domestic authoritarian techniques, internet censorship, foreign NGOs, all of these sorts of things. And so, I mean, I think this is the question when it comes to how the two sides look at each other. You do have increasingly a view that is a common strategic outlook that says that the primary challenge that they both face is their contest, again, not just with the United States, but with the West, with the Western liberal order in general, and a growing willingness, not just on Russia's side, which we've seen over a longer arc, but on the Chinese side, to push back against that more openly and in ways that look more dangerous, as you mentioned in your question with Taiwan. But you do also have this kind of like-mindedness element that's there. Xi Jinping seems to have had an affinity with Putin. He's met with him more than any other leader. He keeps making it a priority to go to Moscow at essentially every opportunity since he Became general secretary of the party, and I think for him his father spent a lot of time in the Soviet Union. There seems to be a particularly kind of fond memory of the better days of the Sino-Soviet alliance there, and so you do have a sense in which the two sides, particularly since the annexation of Crimea in 2014, have really been trying to push past a lot of the outstanding areas of mistrust between them. They already got past all the other issues they used to have. They wouldn't do major energy deals. Russia wouldn't sell China advanced weapons systems. All of these sorts of things we'd already seen. But in the most recent couple of years, as we saw with the joint statement that provides partly the name of the book, the No Limits joint statement that Putin and Xi issued last year, and then reinforced by the visit to Moscow, I think they are finding ways to convert their shared outlook on the world into more practical areas of cooperation, whether that's going to be joint weapon systems development or just the mutual support that's provided economically, diplomatically, and even financially, where they both, I think, want to build a sort of sanctions-resilient international architecture to deal with the sort of things that Russia's been dealing with from US and Western sanctions. So I fear it's heading in a direction that is quite hard to reverse on this, and where the two sides have decided that whatever they dislike about each other, whatever they don't trust about each other, it's more important that they're able to get past those issues because it's sufficiently important on the single most important struggle that they have.
Yeah, well, I'm also struck, and you mentioned in the book their affinity for Stalin. Neither one of them backs off one iota in believing in Stalin's legacy, which brings up an interesting thing. I'm a facial coder, so I look at people's expressions, and in writing a book called Two Cheers for Democracy, I spent a lot of time in the last section looking at the question of, is there a kind of a signature emotional nature to someone who's an autocratic leader versus a more open democratic leader. And it often came down to how much disgust and anger they showed. In Putin's case, and there is a separation here, I'm curious if you think this plays in any way. In Putin's case, I did see anger, but I also saw fear and contempt, whereas Xi is pretty uniformly buttoned up, and it's a small smirk of contempt, a little semblance of a smile, and a lot of focus, a lot of very low-grade anger. So it's the fear that stands out as a difference between them. And of course, Putin is now the more junior partner in this emerging coalition.
That's very interesting. I think it's interesting the degree to which on Xi Jinping's part, he's had to do this kind of bending over backwards job to conceal and restrain whatever skepticism and whether it's contempt or not. Clearly on the Chinese side, there is a view that Russia has made some calculations that have weakened its position, that the judgment calls have been wrong in important ways. I think that's going to be how they see in the end the invasion of Ukraine as well. I think that's a calculation that they would have considered to be ill-judged. They thought that there were some previous military adventures that Russia had been involved in, including the annexation of Crimea, including what they did in Syria that were relatively successful. But I think you do have this question on the Chinese side about whether there is this kind of looking down on where Russia is now, but simultaneously an understanding that you have to dampen this down. You have to make sure that you show Russia respect, that you show Putin respect, and that this is the precondition to being able to establish the kind of relationship that you need. And I mention in the book this moment after Crimea, where Xi Jinping essentially issues this edict to all of the companies that are going in to negotiate with the Russians on the Chinese side to say to them, don't negotiate as if these companies are, have their backs against the wall, don't exploit them. This is something we'd seen Chinese companies do before with Iran and certain other countries. But essentially to say the stakes are too high politically and in other ways for you to damage this by going ahead and doing this. Negotiate on normal terms. Don't do stupid deals, but at the same time, don't be exploitative and create that impression. And so I think the way you characterize these dynamics right now and what you were seeing it's not a bad encapsulation of some of those trends that we're seeing on the Chinese side and how this has moved. And certainly Russia and Putin in a much more anxious position on this at the moment. The balance has shifted quite markedly. And in a certain sense, for Russia, this is now a matter of necessity that China is a partner. For China, yeah. There's still an element of choice to this. This is a decision that Xi Jinping has made himself also to move as closely to Russia in these circumstances. And he could decide otherwise in principle. And I think that's reflected now in the political dynamics that we see between them.
Yeah, well, I've traveled in both countries, and China, of course, struck me as very productive, very focused, and Russia as much more disorganized. Even almost chaotic in some ways. So the U.S. military, if I'm not mistaken, recently said that they anticipated a strong possibility, at least, that China could move on Taiwan within the next 5 years. I sort of asked that question earlier, kind of got you had a very good answer, but we didn't quite get there. Do you have any perspective on that? Do you have the same foreboding that seems the Pentagon has?
Yes, I mean, I suppose I answered some of the China Russia piece of this, but on that part, what we have on the timelines for this is we have a timeline from that Xi Jinping has put in place for kind of military readiness, and this is going to be a big threshold that China crosses in the next few years. I think the intended timetable for this is 2027. But I think what you're seeing in terms of what the Pentagon and various others on the US side are now raising is this is going to be a matter of choice for China as well. It's going to be a question of when and if they can seize Taiwan rather than whether they're capable of doing it at all. And that simply hasn't been true before. And so I think there's a lot more anxiety right now about what the calculations are on the Chinese side, about getting deterrence right, about getting Taiwan's defense right, and about whether one could be surprised by and miscalculate when China might decide to move. My assessment is, I mean, my own assessment is that, China's still not ready, and I'm still not sure whether they're going to be confident enough, particularly given the lack of combat experience that the PLA has. They haven't been involved in a war since 1979, and I think they're still going to be questions on the Chinese side, and particularly after what they've seen in the last year about sure. whether they make a big miscalculation there, because they've got one shot at getting this right in a certain sense. If they get it wrong, there's a real risk to the party's legitimacy. And I think what they're also trying to assess is how much damage is caused, for instance, to their long-term economic situation in the way that we're seeing with Russia. Sanctions haven't prevented Russia from doing what it's doing or changed its approach on the battlefield, but they're going to impair Russia's technological progress and its entire economic future as a result of this. And in some ways, this matters more to China even than it does to Russia. So I still think there's going to be hesitation, but we're going to move into a zone on this where they may see an opportunity at a certain moment, and they may see a window in which they decide they have to act. And we're going into essentially a much more dangerous few years as a result of that.
Sure. Two more questions before we end. I remember when I was in Beijing and in the Forbidden City, there was a plaque that essentially said that they saw themselves, China, as the center of the universe. Well, we have Macron in Beijing. Mm-hmm. So we have this whole dance of protecting our democracy, and yet we also want economic viability, and China's a big market. How do you see those tensions between upholding democracy and upholding the economy playing out, maybe particularly from a European perspective?
I mean, this was a tricky visit where I think the European side, and Macron brought the European Commission president with him as well, Ursula von der Leyen, partly to send a message on Ukraine, partly on this China-Russia question, and to signal essentially that if China were to provide lethal aid to to Russia, this would have significant damage on the wider relationship with Europe. Macron, of course, trying to solicit China's help as well to put pressure on Russia, even though that, for the reasons we've discussed, I think it's completely unrealistic. But simultaneously bringing this huge business delegation with him. As you know, von der Leyen in the week before had made this very significant speech in which she kind of laid out this pretty forceful case about concerns about where China was headed and talking about European need to de-risk. I think there's a big debate at the moment about what de-risking amounts to. Are you essentially just taking the steps needed to cut off China's access to the most sensitive technologies and maybe reduce dependencies in a few risky areas? Or are you really unraveling some of the economic relationship that's built up between the two sides and trying to create the conditions not to have broader market dependencies on China, not to risk various industrial sectors. And I think that's in Europe certainly a debate that's sharpening at the moment. But where I think on the domestic piece of this, which says there are areas in which the presence of, for instance, Chinese tech firms in the European digital infrastructure could pose real risks to not necessarily the fundamentals of democracy here in Europe, but that certainly can have a pernicious effect on this. I think that's really a debate that's moved much faster and harder in that direction in the last few years. I think there was just a big difference between the intertwining of normal trade ties versus the intertwining of this kind of deep level of involvement of Chinese technology in European infrastructure. And the book, for instance, spends a lot of time on 5G and everything that played out on that front, for instance. But I think some of these things are being wrestled with by everyone at the moment, because we all still have huge commercial relationships with China, even in the middle of all of this. It's true for the US, it's true for Japan, it's true for India. For anyone who's anxious about where China's headed and the security and democracy risks that China poses, we're doing this in an environment in which we still have this absolutely vast trading relationship at the same time to navigate.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So last question. Winston Churchill, of course, very famously characterized Russia as a riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma. I'm curious how you might characterize China today.
I mean, the helpful thing about China right now is Xi Jinping has made a lot of things a lot less enigmatic. We had to do a lot of deciphering back in the day, and we had to read China's intentions carefully and try and make sense and interpret all of these things. There were internal party documents, there were public statements, and there was what was in the legal system and what was done informally, all of this sort of thing. Xi Jinping's just put a lot of this stuff out there. I mean, if we go to his speech from even a few weeks ago at the National People's Congress, he now just talks openly about Western containment, encirclement, and there's a much more explicit framing on Xi Jinping's part about struggle. He puts in law things like, if you see things like the national intelligence law that require Chinese firms to allow Chinese intelligence services to access to things like data these were the sorts of things that were going on anyway. But he's just made a lot of this much more explicit and direct when he talks economically as well about the importance of building other countries' dependencies on China so as to build a counterforce against Western containment and things like that. I mean, these things are just, he just helpfully spells these things out. In lots of cases, he acts on them. I mean, you can always look at party documents and say, well, this is just about aspirations, or it's a critique of things that haven't happened yet. In lots of these cases, this has been a pretty good guide to what Xi Jinping then actually goes about doing. So I think it's been a very helpful thing in the last few years for anyone who was trying to decipher what was actually going on the Chinese side. The system is harder to deal with. It used to be that you would, you'd have your friends who would give readouts of internal party discussions and things like that. At the moment, Xi Jinping makes all of this stuff pretty clear. And so I think in one way, it's become a little bit easier, particularly with the concentration of power that he has as well, to be able to interpret, at least in the coming coming years where things are headed in a way that I think beforehand you had to decipher a whole series of different factions in the party, different interest groups and things. At the moment, it's Xi Jinping, and it's pretty much what he says he wants to do.
Yeah, no, I think that's an absolutely excellent answer. Wonderful stuff. So I want to thank you, Andrew, so much for being my guest here today. For my listeners, this has been episode 132, Can China Build a Coalition? My guest, Andrew Small, he is the author once again of No Limits, The Inside Story of China's War with the West. If you've enjoyed today's show, please give it a rating or review on iTunes. Finally, as listeners know, I like to conclude every episode with an epigram. In this case, I found something from the poet W.H. Auden, who I think meant this as a joke, but the world has changed so much that it might actually prove to be prophecy. He said, "I'll love you, dear. I'll love you till China and Africa meet, and the river jumps over the mountain, and the salmon sing in the street." Until next time, take care and be well.